And yo, what is a cipher?
Hip hop that I love.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to Brian Coleman. Coleman is the author of the newly released Check the Technique, Volume 2. The book is a collection of what he calls invisible liner notes, detailed inside information about the making of some of the greatest hip-hop records of all time. Volume 2 is actually the third book in his series of invisible liner notes, which started with Rakim Told Me in 2005. This book gives the inside scoop into classic albums from groups like Company Flow, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, KMD, Black Star, and plenty more. Coleman interviewed producers, group members, engineers, basically anyone involved with the record to come up with the definitive story of how the album was made. The books are beloved both by hip-hop scholars like Jeff Chang and Harry Allen, and artists like Questlove and Chuck D. We talked to Coleman at our home, Crosstown Studios in Harlem, just days after the book was published. Thanks for coming through.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Right, just a few days after Check the Technique 2 is published.
Yes, it's been a whirlwind. I'm self-publishing this time around, so it's I'm literally publicist, author, publisher, shipping dock, manager, you know, it's definitely a one-man army going on.
That decision to self-publish, did that, I know you were kind of a punk rock kid growing up, did that go back to that whole sort of DIY punk thing?
Very much. I mean, yeah. And also, I mean, I think that carries over into hip-hop too, you know, clearly like Schoolie D Records and the early Def Jam stuff. And there was so much great indie stuff coming out, but certainly labels like SST and Discord and kind of the, I've always admired artists and labels who just don't ask permission. They don't wait around. I mean, they might try. Schoolie D always told me the story how people were just like, you can't do that. You can't make that music. That's not right. You can't swear like that. And he was just like, yes, I can. And I'll do it myself. So I kind of take a little bit of that spirit from my first book, from Rakim Told Me. And I'm bringing it back to that. The one before this was through Random House, which was also a cool experience, but I definitely prefer to have more control over everything. So I'm in the place I'm supposed to be.
And just for people who might not know, can you tell, give them a little bit of what the book's about?
So the book is what I call invisible liner notes for hip-hop albums. They're basically liner notes for hip-hop records specifically, and hip-hop records very rarely had them. So that was always kind of strange to me, and I was never sure why that was. And honestly, it doesn't really matter. It's just a fact. So I've been, over the last 9 years, kind of retroactively going back and fitting them with liner notes that hopefully, you know, that maybe they should have had the first time around. So that's really what it is. And it ranges from kind of more relatively obscure but still very important artists like Ultramagnetic MCs to super multi-platinum, you know, Naughty by Nature's in the new one, and there's Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, and so it's really the range, the full range of hip-hop, from everything from super serious to, you know, Biz Markie and Too Short and Two Live Crew, and it's really just hip-hop that I love, and some of that overlaps with what some people may consider the greatest hip-hop albums of all time, and some of it may be outside that, but it's really just hip-hop that's always engaged me and that I've always wanted to know more about. So I've taken it upon myself to do that and then share it with other people who I know will enjoy it.
And the liner notes thing, you were a jazz critic for a while or involved in?
I wasn't a critic. I was actually a publicist. So okay. I worked for a company in Boston, a small PR company called Braithwaite & Katz for the 90s, most of the 90s and half of the 2000s. So for instance, I work with Modesky Martin and Wood from when they just started through kind of when they blew up. Blowing up is a relative term, but it, within the kind of jam band world and the jazz world, they were superstars at that point in the mid-90s. And so I always was aware of where liner notes stood in the jazz world.
Right. I was going to say, you have this, you know, going back even to the 50s and certainly in the 60s, you have like the long adoring essay from Nat Hentoff and the like, you know, detailed who played on what day and who engineered it and so forth.
I always enjoyed that. I always thought it was important. And I guess even though it wasn't something that, that kind of manifested itself until the first book I did, it always just hit me as strange. Like, why didn't hip hop have those, that same, the liner notes per se, and or even an approximation of them? I mean, really what liner notes became was the, you know, quote unquote shout outs. And it could be anything from as in depth as the Extra Strength Posse stuff on Public Enemy Records to literally just a little teeny paragraph on another random hip hop record. And in the foreword to the book, Adam Mansbach kind of talks a little bit about how you piece together your own liner notes in your head, you know, with hip hop records. And that was fine too. But I always, I guess at some point I said, you know, why don't we make this a more formalized thing? And I guess that's what I have been doing for the last 9 years or so.
Yeah. Well, there was also this thing that started, I don't exactly know when it started, but it was kind of de rigueur in the early 90s of like the last track of the record would be shout outs.
Yeah.
I guess the Beastie Boys did that as far back as like 89 or so. What you gonna do?
I mean, that was definitely something that happened and was kind of another way of just kind of talking about who was in your circle, who was in your, who you were influenced by, who supported you, who helped you out. And that was cool. That was good. There was a book that came out, I don't even remember, at some point, I think in the 2000s. And the guy who did it, it was literally just called Shoutouts. And it was a photocopied kind of fanzine style of just random shoutouts from the backs of hip hop records. And it was cool to have them all in one place because you could, I guess that was a, you know, one version of putting it all. So you could say, and actually the funny thing about those, I don't even think it said where they were from. It didn't even say the album. So there was always like a mystery and there was like an accomplishment that you felt when you could kind of connect those dots yourself. You know, when you looked at a Public Enemy record or a Big Daddy Kane record and you could say, oh yeah, so that guy knows him and he works at that studio. And when you know more about the context of records, whether you already love them or not, it can't do anything but make you like them more when you realize what went into the process, what was that artistic process like? And because they're all very, very different. And whether it was a group who was kind of working on their own island, or whether it was the Native Tongues who had this whole kind of support unit behind them and everyone was going back and forth in sessions, it's always fascinated me. So I think the way that hip hop music is made in its own way is just so different from any other kind of music. The way that it's put together with the DJ is usually the producer, but not always. And the producer in hip hop is very different than the producer in rock. I mean, the producer in rock is kind of put the microphones in the right place and do this take and maybe do this. But the producer in hip hop is actually the composer. So many times, and that's a completely different way of making music. So that always fascinated me as well.
One of the kind of themes of the book in a way is the difference between what the credits say and what actually happened. And I think part of that is this model you're talking about where what a producer did was something in rock. And then this new genre pops up and they haven't quite figured out what's a producer, what's an executive producer, what's an engineer and so forth. And so they're trying to kind of putting names in there that maybe don't exactly fit what happened, and also sort of the power dynamics of who's in the group and out and who's new and who's a 16-year-old kid.
Yeah.
You know,
no, it's true.
Is one of the themes of the book, I think.
I would definitely agree in that the dynamics are always different. It's hard for, like, in a rock group, I guess it's harder to say, oh, I composed that, you know, as the producer. Like, I wrote that whole song. Whereas in hip-hop, for sure, the producer usually does that. But then it's kind of like, well, I gave you that bass line, and so I should get, you know, I'm a composer. And that's interesting to me, because that's a legitimate thing. In hip-hop, different, you have this bass line here, and here's this drum break, and then this changes up, and then there's this horn stab, and you didn't write that, you sampled it. But that is also the way that hip-hop is put together, is certainly the way you take different samples is a form of composition, clearly. And it's just very, it's interesting and it's intricate. And the more, I think the more I started learning about it, the more I was fascinated by it and the dynamics within the groups. So whether that was Gangstar, you know, or whether it's the Wu-Tang Clan, I mean, they're absolutely different dynamics. Certainly the more members in a group that you pile on, the more complicated it gets, which is a reason why what RZA accomplished with the Wu-Tang Clan is absolutely incredible. I don't think that people still appreciate how difficult that must have been to keep all of those guys corralled, keep their motivation up, to say, look, your solo album's probably not going to come for 2 or 3 years, but trust me. And that's not easy to do when you're talking with a bunch of cats who are just not, don't have any money, they're still out hustling, and be like, yeah, no, just wait 3 years. I swear to God, you know, this will work. I don't know how he did it. I think it just speaks to his charisma and his leadership, and how people just, those guys all just respected him and trusted him. And he was right.
One of the most interesting chapters in the book is you talk about the Gravediggers album,
mm-hmm.
where he was sort of in the process of becoming the RZA that we see on the Wu-Tang projects, that
yep.
he actually, you know, started using that name
yep.
during the Gravediggers album.
I'm the resurrector, be my sacrifice, commit suicide and I bring you back to life.
Before Wu-Tang, and because it came out after the first Wu-Tang album, I think that chronology maybe isn't that well known.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting, I mean, Prince Paul, who was obviously the head of the Gravediggers, kind of after the fact, people assume, since RZA became a super producer, you know, that he was like the lead dude, but he wasn't. He was just one of the MCs. And Prince Paul's, you know, very proud of the fact, like, yeah, you know, I made RZA who he was, but I was the first guy who kind of, you know, really supported him and brought him out as an MC, because I think that's the one thing about the Gravediggers record, among many other things. But RZA, that was his, he was purely, I mean, he produced and co-produced a couple of tracks on there, but mostly he was an MC on that record, and a really amazing one. And he was up against, you know, Fruquan and Poetic, who were both incredible too. Because that's definitely one thing that's been lost a little bit, is RZA as an MC. You know, certainly you think of him mostly as a producer, but he could bring it. He could bring it. And a lot of times with Wu-Tang, he chose not to. Maybe he was too busy, but maybe he was just like, you know what, I got a lot of other good guys, and so I'll kind of get on the mic when I need to, but I don't have to every time. So, I think the Gravediggers was really interesting, because it kind of takes, it definitely shows, because they really started in 92, even before the Wu-Tang was kind of a thing, even before Protection Act came out. But by the time it actually came out, because Prince Paul shopped that record for like a year, all of a sudden, Wu-Tang had started blowing up, and the dynamic was...
It's RZA's group, all of a sudden.
...was totally different, yeah. And interestingly, I mean, they toured with the Wu-Tang Clan, so that was kind of interesting in that all of a sudden they were, like, opening for Wu-Tang Clan, even though Gravediggers really came first, at least in how they recorded. So, yeah, there's all kinds of stories like that. There's the interconnection between all these different groups. Gravediggers and Wu-Tang Clan, I guess, is not that radical to think, oh, they're related.
There are a lot of weird connections that pop up in your book, though. Like, just to take Kwame, for example.
Yeah.
Right? Went to high school with, like, Prodigy and Pharoah Monch.
Yeah.
Was family friends with Jean Grey's father. Like, all kinds of crazy... Like, what other sort of connections popped up that you were really surprised you?
Surprised? I don't know. I don't... Honestly, I don't know if any of them really surprised me, because it's... When you're talking about New York in the late 80s, early to mid 90s, I mean, all these guys were kind of... in everybody else's sessions, and you would drop by and you'd be over at Calliope and let's go over to D&D and see what's going on there. And I think that's the beauty of it, is how it was like a, not a clubhouse. I mean, D&D was a clubhouse. You know, everybody was, I was just talking to Evil D the other night about what that was like, because you'd have, Premiere was in that room and the beat miners were in the other room. And then, you know, here Jay-Z's coming through, and Nas, and other producers too, who weren't even doing sessions. So Pete Rock would stop by, or Q-Tip would stop by, and there was a one-upmanship and a competition. And I don't think that exists anymore, really, because everybody does. That kind of atmosphere doesn't really exist in as many studios, because you can record stuff very easily at your home or on your computer or whatever, email MP3s around, you know, across the world and things like that. And I think that you lose a lot when you don't have that kind of camaraderie, but also, you know, just be like, oh man, did you hear that latest Pete Rock thing? Like, we gotta step up our game. Like, we gotta really, That was crazy. Like, how can we flip it even, like, crazier than he did it? And, oh, man, did you hear what RZA did? And, you know, so you'd talk to, like, Premier and RZA would be kind of talking to each other about who did the illest piano thing. I think, you know, the Premier talks about that a little bit in the J. Rue the Damager chapter, how, you know, what was iller, like Cream or some of the piano stuff he was doing with that.
I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job at second hand.
Dirty like a scam, bro. That's what I'm called on the street. Good conniving cheap, but really it be. You see, I'm streetwise.
They always knew that they could, yeah, my next thing I do is gonna be even doper than that, but that's dope, you know. So it wasn't, they were mad. They were loving hip hop, and they were fans too. And that's I think the really important thing, is that once you have that kind of atmosphere where everybody is just trying to make the dope stuff, they're not trying to outsell anyone. That it wasn't about who was selling or who was on what label or anything. It was just about making amazing music, and it was still exciting, I think, back then. And that still exists now, but I really don't feel that it exists in the same way.
I wanted, you know, sort of a side note I wanted to bring up. In the third bass chapter, a good friend of the show, Blake Lethem, Keo, mm-hmm. comes up a fair amount as kind of this hidden factor who wasn't actually in the group but was around and was an influence. He's great. He's been a guest in the past. I was just curious, like, what other kind of, like, personalities just on the outside of projects did you come across that maybe you didn't think had as big an influence as they did, or something like that?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think. I mean, Blake is a really good example, because he was part of the Kango crew, K-A-N-G-O, because they were a crew, not a hat. I remember Dana Dane told me one time. And that was, you know, very important. I mean, like, so Juju, I think, was an early kind of member and kind of inner circle dude with all the Native Tongues, starting with the Jungle Brothers, Juju from the Beatnuts. And so I think that's an important connection too. I think the Beatnuts don't usually get enough credit for what they did. And they were never an ingrained part of any one studio or any one clique. They kind of existed a little bit off to the side and on their own, maybe because Les wasn't, like, the most social dude. And, you know, Juju would kind of talk a little bit about how he had to convince people sometimes, like, no, give Les a chance. You know, I know he comes off like a little strong sometimes, but they were, their digging and the kind of the samples that they came up with were pretty important. And, you know, I think you wouldn't really put the Beatnuts and the Jungle Brothers together necessarily, but Juju was that link between them. And so that's one interesting one I thought was cool. But yeah, Blake, he was, as you know, Search calls it, he was the original white MC. Like, he was the first. And the interesting thing that those guys always mentioned was that Blake always did it for the fun of it and because he loved hip hop, but he almost didn't want to record. Like, it didn't sound like he, that was just a very kind of like, why would I want to record? I just want to rhyme. Like, I don't care about putting out a record. And he did record, but, you know, that's, I think, interesting too, because there are not as many people who do that anymore just for the love. You know, it's always, I want to get this out and I want to put this on my mixtape and all this thing. And that's kind of important, because he was a pioneer, and I never got the sense from those guys that he was bitter about never being a big star or never being in third base. Like, I don't think he cares at all, because he never really wanted that. He wanted to rhyme, and obviously he wanted to write, you know, as a graffiti artist, and he's still doing amazing stuff to this day.
And still close with those guys.
Exactly.
You know, I saw him with Search not long ago.
Yeah, there's definitely no bitterness. There's no, oh, you guys ripped me off and that kind of thing at all. So, but that's, I think that's great. That's important, in that there have to be pioneers who are willing to kind of share and influence each other and not really care about credits. Good to get, but just to kind of do it for the love. You know, that's a rare thing.
One final third base thing, which is like, there's this great moment in the book where they get asked to do Beverly Hills 90210 and they turn it down, and you talk to Pete Nice and he kind of regrets it a little bit. Oh, we thought it was corny, but maybe it could have, you know, done huge things for us.
It's, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much they regret it. I think it's more just kind of wondering what if.
Right.
I mean, honestly, I think it would have been corny if they were on there. So, you know, so yeah, it's interesting sometimes talking about things like that.
You do have a lot of these what if moments in your book, if not stated, definitely implied, like, oh, this was only added at the last minute, mm-hmm. and then it became the definitive thing.
Yeah, I think that's always the important thing about the way that hip hop is made, but the way music is made. There's always in any group's history and any group's kind of trajectory, the one I'm always fascinated by was, I mean, the Roots were almost never a group, you know, like they were kind of busking and, you know, in South Street in Philadelphia, and people really didn't get what they were trying to do. It was not like a live hip hop band, and I don't, you know, it's kind of jazz and what's going on here. And it was kind of confusing to a lot of people, and maybe not as confusing, but just kind of like, eh. Like, I don't know if that's really going to work. And even within the group, you know, like, am I doing the right thing? And there were always moments when they could have just not gotten together, and their original bassist kind of left and was like, nah, this is not happening. And the thing I always thought was interesting was Amir Questlove, according to him, he never told his dad that he was even in the Roots until they got signed to Geffen.
This is a great moment in the first volume of Check the Technique when he talks about that.
Which is interesting, because so obviously, you know, now that's kind of funny, but his father, who was a musician himself, who was a doo-wop artist, Lee Andrews, he went by, and he desperately wanted Amir to be a, you know, young lion, like in jazz, a Christian McBride type of guy, and wear a suit and do shows and make good money and, you know, have the kind of the Wynton Marsalis kind of lifestyle. And he did everything he could. He sent him to, you know, schools, performing arts school in Philly, so he could do that. And secretly, the only thing Amir ever wanted to do was kind of be in Public Enemy and be in Tribe Called Quest. And so I always thought that was interesting, you know, how they, how there was definitely pressure for him to not be anything but a hip hop artist. But if that's your calling, if that's your passion, then you as an artist, you just kind of follow your heart. So there are definitely a lot of moments in any group where things happen. I mean, I think one of the chapters I'm happiest with and proudest with in the book is the KMD chapter, because that there's definitely a huge what if because Sub Rock was killed.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I want to ask you about that chapter. For those who don't know, KMD is Zev Lovex and Sub Rock. Zev Lovex, several years later, would come back as MF Doom.
Zev Lovex, I be sex like Swite. So crank up the cups and get some ups for the Ziggy Ziggy. I got the guts to rock the mic and grab my nigga nigga.
Someone our listeners would know. Mm-hmm. And when we had Dante Ross on, he talked a lot about the making of that record.
Yep. And it was, the thing that's the most interesting to me that I don't even talk about in the chapter, which is kind of, you know, what I like is that I kind of present certain facts that are gleaned from the actual people who were part of it, including Dante was part of that chapter and Pete Nice and obviously Doom. And it's kind of the thing that I don't think people realize or that maybe they're reminded by that chapter is they were just coming into their own with Black Bastards. I mean, they were still kids, and especially Sub was just starting to rhyme more and become more of the leader instead of the younger brother. And he was just literally cut down in his prime, and he wasn't even in his prime. He was just approaching. So it's kind of like, what would have happened with KMD? What amazing stuff would they have produced, you know, on their third record and their fourth record? And clearly Doom has had an incredible career after that, but which is a testament in its own to just him as a person, because it's almost unimaginable how devastating that was, the 1-2 punch where he was first, his brother was killed, and then he was dropped by his label and literally just pushed out the door with the master tapes in his hand, just like, goodbye, good luck, see you later. And, you know, they tried to sell it to other labels and nobody wanted it. And he just kind of wandered off into the wilderness for a couple of years. And he came back as a totally different MC. I mean, his flow had changed, like his persona clearly had changed completely. His name had changed. And he was following a graphic novel. His life is a graphic novel.
Black, stay in the zone, turn H2O to cognac on Doomsday. Ever since the womb till I'm back where my brother went, that's what my tumor say. Right above my government.
It's pretty incredible what he's done. But that album had just had such a crazy story behind it, because they were dropped by Elektra Records in 1994, a year after Sub Rock was killed. And that album did not surface again for 6 years, officially. There, Bobito put out stuff on Fondulum on his label a couple years later, but that was pretty, you know, low key, kind of underground type stuff. But yeah, I mean, that's a really fascinating record to me. And honestly, it's that one to me more than almost any of the chapters in the book is what would have happened if Sub Rock had lived, because everybody, according to everyone involved, Sub was really starting to come into his own as a powerful force, as a producer and an MC. And Doom was great with that. Like, he was his younger brother, but they were a team. And most people who talk about them say that they were almost the same person. Like, it was almost like they were Siamese twins, and they would finish each other's thoughts, and they didn't even have to talk to each other. And that kind of chemistry is pretty amazing. It's pretty powerful.
One of the crazy things about this book, this volume in particular, is the amount of people who are, you know, either difficult to track down or difficult to, or have reputations at least of being difficult to deal with that you manage to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Doom obviously is a little mysterious, doesn't do that much press. Mm-hmm. Cool Keith, who has been a guest on the show, is difficult to track down.
He can be a little bit, you know, mysterious.
A little mysterious.
I go way back with Cool. I've been writing about Cool Keith since like the mid-90s. So that was kind of cool too, pun intended, I suppose, to be able to revisit. I mean, I wrote about Dr. Octagon as a journalist when it first came out in 95, 96, 97. And so this volume is the first time that I was going back and revisiting albums that I kind of covered when they originally came out. And so it was almost like a family reunion with some of the, like, Company Flow and Dr. Octagon, Black Star, things like that. And it's kind of cool because before I was just a fan when like Public Enemy and Jungle Brothers and De La Soul first came out. I wasn't writing. I wasn't part of the hip hop organism where, you know, there are DJs and writers and producers and labels. I wasn't part of that mechanism, but I was with some of the ones I cover in this volume, which was from a personal level, like, you know, very gratifying too, to look at it through that lens. And I think honestly, you can kind of, people have told me that, yeah, I can really tell with like Company Flow or Dr. Octagon that you really love those records. And I do love those records. It's not like I love them more than like Public Enemy, but it's a whole different feeling when you were you remember the first time you heard. I mean, I could still remember getting the Dr. Octagon demo cassette, like the advanced cassette in the mail, without any context, without any reference, without any sheet. Just like it was like Brian, let me know what you think of Octagon, Dan. And I didn't even know where he got. I think he got my number from my address from like Peanut Butter Wolf or something like that. And I was like, this sounds like Cool Keith. Nah, it can't be Cool Keith.
I crank up lyrical flows, spit spats. What's that? The pattern records. Don't touch the dats. Yo, check out the pro skills. Metaphor fills. Contact, react, the style. I'm back. You lack.
No, this sounds like, this has got to be Cool Keith. And so I called, you know, he had a number and I was like, what the hell is this? And, you know, so that's kind of a magical thing, you know, when you're a radio DJ or a journalist to hear something that just totally blows your mind and even to blow your mind and not have any context to it, which is the same thing that happened with like Company Flow too. And I can remember the first time I heard it, I was like, oh my God, like these guys are out of their minds. This is amazing. Like they're trying to just tear down like everything that hip hop is right now. And it's I love it.
One of the great things about the book, this happens in the Company Flow chapter and in the Coup chapter. The Coup's, you know, one of my favorites. So I read that one extra carefully. You have a lot of commentary from to the less well-known people in the group, and I think that's kind of one of the fascinating things. You know, you have so much about Len, the Mr. Len Company Flow's DJ, and his life and what he went through, including some pretty shocking medical things that he went through during making the record. And in the Coup chapter, there's the great moment where you have Pam the Funkstress, the DJ. She responds to some of Boots' more like incendiary songs and says, oh, well, I don't really get down with that, but that's just him. You know how he is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like Piss on Your Grave is the one she's just like, oh, that's just Boots. I don't know.
One thing I got to ask George Washington down in hell. Can you see me? I'm standing on your grave and I'm fixing to take a pee-pee.
But, you know, it's interesting, too, because she said as a female DJ back then, she's like, I love Too Short and I love NWA, but I just could never, ever DJ for a group like that because of the way they talked about women. But Boots was always very respectful, and that was important because she had to be very careful. I mean, it's very, to be a female in hip hop is a kind of a treacherous path sometimes you walk, and you have to be careful about the way you're portrayed and who you align yourself with, because there certainly is a lot of kind of anti-female stuff in hip hop, whether it's just kind of lip service. It doesn't really matter if they really mean it, or whether it's just, you know, you just call women bitches. I mean, that's like serious stuff that you have to keep in mind. So I thought that was interesting. And it says a lot about Boots too, is that there were two things. First of all, he was always respectful of her and just women in general. But secondly, he was very professional. And so he said, I'll call you next Tuesday, and he would call next Tuesday, and you'd be surprised at how many times that doesn't happen, not just in hip-hop, but, you know, musicians and artists have their own kind of timetable and way of dealing with appointments and things of that nature. So
yeah, definitely. One of the great things about the book also is the visuals that pop up, a lot of them from Bill Adler from his archives. He's a two-time guest on the show. We love him. Great, nice. Great supporter. But from his incredible archive, which I got to peek through once or twice before it made its way to Cornell.
Yeah.
Yes. And then the visuals, like in addition to that, there's just so much crazy stuff. Pictures of like white labels and demo cassettes and promo things. And like, can you tell us a little about the visual side of the book?
Yeah. I mean, so that was definitely a a hugely important part for me with this new volume. It was something I'd never really done before. This time I wanted to make sure everything in each chapter was of that era. So if it was an Ice Cube photo, it had to be from 1990 when America's Most Wanted came out. And so it was probably 2 months that I took, just 2 months purely of gathering visuals, licensing stuff. But I didn't license a ton of photos. I was very fortunate in that some photographers even let me use some of their stuff for free. Others certainly gave me the quote-unquote bro rate, you know, just because they're friends. Like someone like Jeanette Beckman, who could command large dollars, was very kind. And she has an amazing Stetsasonic photo that's in there because she took the cover of In Full Gear. And so everything was of that era. And it ranges from scans of like the label of a single, or like you mentioned, white labels. I also went back in a lot of old magazines like Source, Rap Masters, going back to the late 80s, Rap Pages, and I would get like advertisements that had come out when that album hit. And then but I think the real coup was definitely getting access to the Bill Adler archives at Cornell, which have still not really been cataloged. So I got an early look, and Bill was very kind, and the people at Cornell, Catherine and Ben, are amazing.
Shouts to Catherine and Ben. They're
no
great.
Doubt. I mean, what they're doing there is really important, and it's very authentic the way that they're going about it. It's not in any, it's kind of giving hip hop the respect it deserves, you know, from an archival perspective. But it's also not making it too stiff and sterile and kind of putting it in a real library type of environment, like slap your hand when you get too close to touching it. I mean, they're doing it in an incredible way. And I was very fortunate. I was only there for 2 days, and in the absolute height of last winter, which was horrible. I remember walking to the library.
Ithaca's pretty nasty in the winter.
And it's in Ithaca, so it's no joke there. And I'm coming from Boston, but Ithaca's like, and so it was like right in between two storms. I remember walking to the library and looking at my thermometer in my car, and it was like 4 degrees, and I'm like, what in the hell am I doing? But it was absolutely worth it. And I think, I don't know if the public can necessarily walk in, but they do have a separate part of the archive that there's one part which is like the whole white glove archival thing, and you know, you have to take out one item at a time or one box at a time. But they do have a display room too, so if you're ever in that area, I think that it is accessible during certain hours for the public, and that's important too. So it's not it is in Ithaca, which isn't like, you know, if you live in New York City, it's not down the street, but they're not putting it in this kind of ivory tower and behind, you know, thick pane glass, so you can't touch it. I mean, I think what Shadow and Cut Chemist just did with the Bombada Records on that tour, the Renegades of Rhythm tour, was amazing.
This was for people to know, they took Afrika Bambaataa donated his entire, you know, tens and tens of thousands of records collection to the Hip Hop Archive at Cornell. A small selection of that, those guys actually brought out on tour with them and DJed every night.
Yeah.
With a selection of Bambaataa's records.
With his actual records, which, and then so there were visuals of, because he used to kind of catalog everything and put numbers on all his records, and so they had the actual pictures of them, which is cool too, because in the age of the kind of mega DJ and, you know, all these people making millions of dollars, and, you know, Cut Chemist and Shadow do well, but there's a beautiful thing to kind of remember where it all came from. And it's not all Serato, you know, and this all came from stuff and lugging crates. And that's really important to remember. So, yeah, so kind of going back, the visuals are a hugely important part this time, because for two reasons. First of all, I think it helps the chapters kind of flow, but also because it breaks up the text a little bit. But it also makes it so that there's constantly something that is kind of drawn back to the text. And you can just kind of glance at it, read it, and kind of contextualize it, and then go back to it. Also, too, I should mention that the Apple ebook, and at some point I'll do the Kindle, those are all in color, too. The book itself, they're all in black and white, which I just couldn't afford to print the books in color. But the ebooks, they're all of the same images are in color, and you can kind of expand them and make them even bigger, which is a cool experience as well.
Jumping back to Cornell just for a second, something kind of tangential I wanted to ask you about is sort of the state of like archiving and studying hip hop now that, you know, at least by some measures, the culture just turned, depending on how you count, 40 or 41.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, with you have the Adler archives, you have, you know, Marcy at the hip hop archive at Harvard.
Yep.
You have even sort of the, you know, artists like Ninth Wonder and Questlove teaching at the college level. It seems like there's kind of a growing tendency to study and archive hip hop that maybe, you know, was much smaller 5 or 10 years ago.
I honestly think that the progress has been somewhat slow in the past 10 years, slower than it should be, because once it's established that this is something that, I mean, universities want to do this for two reasons, because they think it's important, but honestly, because they know this is what kids listen to, and so this is how they're going to fill their classes. If you get somebody like Questlove teaching a class at NYU, it's going to be packed all the time for obvious reasons, because he's Questlove and he's, you know, can talk for days and days and say funny stuff, and he's great and he knows so much. So I just got an email the other day from the Smithsonian, and they're compiling some kind of a greatest hits, or, you know, kind of the essential hip hop recordings. There's a little bit of a lag. I mean, it's not shocking to me that in 1982, people weren't like, oh my God, we have to study hip hop and put it in the university, because it wasn't that old. I mean, they weren't doing that with rock and roll in 1965 either. So there's always a lag between when something kind of makes its way into the popular consciousness and when it is deemed worthy of study. So yeah, I think it's great. I think it's happening more and more, and I think it'll continue to happen more and more. As you get more people, you know, like Dan Charnas's book was just absolute, Big Payback was amazing.
And how
I think that book was very important too. I think Jeff Chang with Can't Stop, Won't Stop really set the bar very high. And then from the business aspect, then Charnas came in and made it so that people who might not really care about hip hop, but care more about the economics of it and kind of what it means. It's undeniable that hip hop culture is a huge influence on, you know, marketing and advertising and things like that. So even people who could care less will read those books and learn more about it, because they're just like, okay, wow, yeah, so that's what Rockefeller did, and oh, Rick Rubin, now I understand a little more, and Russell Simmons.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, can't talk about marketing in hip hop you know, without talking about Puffy, and one of the big themes that comes up in your book, in the Company Flow chapter and in the Black Star chapter, is something I remember very well. I was living in Boston in the early aughts, and I remember very well the divide between like the sort of, you know, underground and mainstream fans.
Yeah.
Where you had people who, you know, loved Puffy and Biggie, and people who thought Puffy was the Antichrist and everything evil. One of the very interesting things about the Black Star chapter for me is Quali plays this role of, you know, being an iconic person on Raucous and Black Star is this sort of huge, you know, thing on the label. But he was friends with Puffy. He knew Puffy as a party promoter. He wasn't anti-mainstream at all in the way so many of his fans were.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, because I think that also speaks to the dynamic in that group of Mos Def, Yasiin Bey, and Talib Kweli, and how different they were, because Mos wasn't really very shy about, you know, calling out, you know, he's the one who kind of started
the
volley.
Sort of quasi Puffy diss song with the Slick Rick remake.
And this is what he said. Me and you, kid, we gonna make some cash. Jacking old beats and making the dash.
They jacked the beats, money came with ease. But Sonny couldn't stop us like he had a disease. He jacked another and another. Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder. Sex him on repeat over the track.
Exactly. So, like, you know, and then Quali, that put him in a weird position. But, you know, that's kind of the beauty of it, in that they were very different people. They were very different in the way they approached their method to rhyming. I mean, Quali, I think the one thing that's interesting to me in that chapter, among other things, but is how they approach things. And I think the song Respiration, which is my favorite one on the record, that was one of the singles on the Black Star album, it talks about Quali his method was very systematic, you know, like he prepared everything and he probably redid his lyrics many times, and it was, you know, they had this one beat and that was the one that he was working on for months and months as they tried to get Common, who was the guest on that track, to be part of it. And then at the last minute, they were just like, I don't really like that track. Let's use a whole different one. And Mos Def could really care less, because he just would walk in and just really freestyled a lot of the stuff he did, or at least was not sitting there for days and days working on his lyrics. It was much more natural for him, which doesn't mean it's better or worse. It just means that he was more of kind of a guy who would come in and just riff and work on things and make it work. Whereas Quali really was very systematic and worked everything out. I mean, MC Search kind of talks about in the Gas Face, like his in the third bass chapter talks about that and how he was, you know, killing himself to write different ways and he just couldn't get it right. And so anyways, it talks about how Talib Kweli was kind of freaking out. Like all of a sudden he was almost
forced. They changed the beat on him.
He was almost forced to rhyme or kind of work in the way that Mos Def always worked in. But it was good for him. Like he talks about how it was also that was good because I was maybe too stiff before, and that kind of helped me to think in a different way and not be so rigid.
Even in deep city breaths, sitting on shitty steps, we stooped to new lows. Hell froze the night the city slept. The beasts crept through concrete jungles, communicating with one another, and ghetto birds were waters for from the hydrants to the gutters.
Because keep in mind, I mean, they were not seasoned artists at that point. I mean, Mos Def had put out records before with some of his siblings in a group called Urban Thermo Dynamics, and they had put out singles, but they were far from kind of seasoned veterans at that point. So I think that's the thing too that I always like is people who you think of now because of the careers they've had as these professionals and veterans, but they weren't always like that, you know. And even as much as you listen to like the Black Star album or you listen to the Gas Face and you think, wow, like these guys are, they're just killing it. It's the process leading up to that. It's kind of all about not really letting people know that you're struggling through some of that and that you're not infallible. I think the one comment I've always enjoyed was Prince Paul talking about the first De La Soul record, 3 Feet High and Rising. He was saying, like, I had no idea what I was doing. I literally didn't know what I was doing, but my main goal was not letting those guys know that I didn't know what I was doing, because they would be like, oh my God, like, he doesn't know what he's doing. We don't know what we're doing. This is horrible. And everyone would freak out. So Paul was figuring it out along the way as he went. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that these guys are all kind of human beings and they kind of struggle with stuff artistically just the same as anyone else would, and that they're not. There was a point in, I think, Chuck D in the first two books talking about the song Bring the Noise, how he just struggled with his lyrics and there were three different approaches. And I would never think of Chuck D, I wouldn't even think of him stubbing his toe. Like, I think of him as just like this kind of superhuman being. So it's always interesting to think of these guys that they have some of the same struggles in different ways, but they still kind of have to work at their craft even to this day, and certainly back then.
What is it about debuts? There are a ton of, across the three books, I would say probably, I haven't counted, but probably majority debut albums with yep. second records sort of close behind, and maybe nothing after that, or very few albums that are third
records
or beyond.
I did BC Boys Check Your Head, which was a rarity to do like a third record. But
right, and the question about that is sort of why not Paul's Boutique, right? Why not the second?
Well, actually, because Dan Leroy had already done the Paul's Boutique book, the 33 and a third, which is a
pretty definitive,
incredible
yeah,
book.
Yeah.
And I was like, why would I go any? So actually, I kind of, you know, skipped right over it and just said, if you want to know more about Paul's Boutique, read Dan's book. Like, I think I even said that in the chapter. I think there's something about debut albums. Well, there's two things to it. There's something about the innocence that produces a debut album, that you haven't yet kind of become jaded by the industry and you haven't become saddled with, oh, I need another hit because that last one. And, you know, like Naughty by Nature is there's a chapter in this new one on what most people think is their first album, which is actually their second album. They were a group called the New Style.
You say the first one was under a different name.
Yeah, it was under the New Style, but it was the same guys, and it bombed almost as much as any record has ever bombed. I mean, it went straight into the cutout bins. There was some okay stuff on it, but yet again, they hadn't found their voice yet. But anyways, so I'm always interested in the early history of a group and the members of each group. So if you're talking about the fifth album of a group, then it's harder to, you kind of have to skip over stuff. And I don't really like to do that. I don't like to have to say, I mean, honestly, with the Beastie Boys, I would have loved to have done License to Ill, but they wouldn't do it. You know, they wouldn't talk about it because they don't, I think that they're still working through some demons with that record of kind of, they were just dumb kids, you know, and they said some stuff that I don't think they're proud of. I don't think any of it was massively offensive, but it was, you know, as upstanding members of the society and kind of, you know, Free Tibet and all this stuff that, yeah, that I could see why.
Right. They wouldn't want to talk about a record whose original title was Don't Be a Faggot.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, there are certainly things that I don't blame them for not wanting to. It was a ridiculously important record. But anyway, so I think that there's the whole not wanting to skip over multiple years and talking about a fourth or a fifth album. But it's also the early history. And I remember speaking with Eric Sermon for the first book about the first EPMD record. And halfway through the interview, he said he was kind of going back over the tracks in his mind. He's like, that really was a good record, wasn't it? And because he had forgotten, because I think he's dealt with so much crap in the industry over so many years that you kind of forget that why you loved making music in the first place. It wasn't because you're being paid X amount per track or because you were signed to this label. You were doing it because you just loved hip hop and you just wanted to, you were influenced by all these people that came before you and you just wanted to, I just wanted a record out. Like the intro page to the book is a quote of the new book is a quote from Jazzy Jeff, and it's basically saying, all I ever wanted to do was just have a record out. I just wanted a record with my name on it. That's all I wanted. Then I could, you know, work for the post office and I would kind of bring it out at family reunions and, hey, I was on a record. And how could they have known that they would have become these ridiculous, huge superstars and, you know, Grammys and all this stuff.
And could potentially have been even gianter stars, which is a story we'll have to save for people who read the book.
Exactly. So to finish that thought is I think there's an importance to that innocence that comes with your first or second record. And I also like kind of second chances. I mean, we talked like the Fugees got a second chance. They didn't have to get that second chance. They could have been dropped. And then who knows, yet again, another what if. The Beastie Boys could have easily just faded away and said, you know, like, let's just break up. This is obviously our label hates us. And instead or, you know, MF Doom could have very easily, God knows what could have happened to him. He could have faded off in something, you know, he could have faded into obscurity. He could have, I don't know what would have happened. I can't imagine what he was going through emotionally when all that stuff happened. So that's always to me is artists just find some kind of inner strength to keep going when they're faced with that adversity. And, you know, sometimes it's adversity that's unfortunate, like with the Fugees, like my record bombed, boo-hoo. Or MF Doom, my brother just got killed, oh my God, and that's legitimate. That's like earth-shattering, world-shattering stuff. So it's just how people respond to adversity, how artists just can't, they just can't do anything else. Like they have to create. Like, and that's what, those are the ones that really kind of engage me. Those are the stories I want to tell.
And two quick things. First off, I do have one beef to pick with a book, which is that in the Ice Cube chapter, going track by track, do not talk about Get Off My Dick and Tell Your Bitch to Come Here.
I'd have to go back and look at my notes, whether I asked them about it and we skipped over it, or whether I was just like, you know what? Yeah, we're good. It's not to say it's not a great track, but Yeah, I'd have to go back and look. It was not an omission because I was afraid of not offending people, because there's plenty of offensive things that people say in the book. So
right. And finally, you refer to these chapters as invisible liner notes. What is your favorite visible liner note on a hip hop record?
Interestingly, I believe it's the first two Salt and Pepper records have liner notes, kind of in the classic jazz sense of they were on the actual back of the record and it's an interview, and it's not the most serious kind of interview, but it talks to all of them. And you'd never really kind of remember or think about that, but those are there. I think the Black Star record actually had liner notes. If you got one of the earlier pressings on vinyl, there's actually a fold-out 4-page thing of liner notes from those guys. The Roots Do You Want More has liner notes. Clearly, the Roots are coming from a jazz background. We're always aware of that. And I think I've always loved that the Roots have starting with the first record, have always never stopped. They don't start at one, track one, with their next record. It's been an ever-evolving, I don't know what number they're up to now, but that's kind of cool. Like, I love that they've done that, and especially as they keep putting out more and more records, that number just continues to grow, and that's a great way to talk about your legacy and kind of that you've been here, like, doing it that long. Makes it a little tricky when you're in the car trying to, forward to the track you're trying to listen to, and you're like, 117, what the hell is that? How am I supposed to deal with track 117? But, oh well.
All right. Well, Brian Coleman, author of Check the Technique, volumes 1 and 2, volume 2 just out. Incredible, incredible book. Definitely worth checking out. So much stuff we didn't even get into, but you'll have to read the book to find out. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks. I really appreciate you guys having me. And yeah, best wishes to you, and keep digging yourself.
It took me a little while to get hip to Coleman's work. I didn't actually pick up on him until Check the Technique Volume 1 a few years back, but his stuff is incredible. The new book, Volume 2, is just a work of art. Like, the pictures in it, like we talk about, are amazing. It's just a great book to actually hold and own a physical copy of. I definitely recommend you get it. This conversation was obviously a bit of a sort of hip-hop geek out. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did, talking the minutiae of, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince and KMD and stuff like that. It was very inspiring to see someone so passionate about telling the stories of these great albums and getting information out there that might otherwise just be lost to the world. All of his books are great, this new one in particular. I mean, this is the stuff in hip-hop and in a lot of music that's just not written down. I mean, people who are making classic records, especially if it's like we talked about, their first or second album, don't necessarily know they're going to be classic. They don't know they're going to be important. And so they don't think of what they're doing necessarily as having, like, historical value. And so it's amazing to have this stuff actually documented in such a cool way. That, to me, is really key to this whole book series of invisible liner notes that Brian is doing. The most important part of this show is you, the audience. Make sure to find us on iTunes and subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Now, while you're there, leave us a review. Those reviews are really important. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like Brian Coleman. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit me up. Let me know what you thought of this show, ideas you have for future guests, anything you might want to talk about. You can also find out all the information about this week's show and find all our past ones at thecyphershow.com. Join us next week when we have a show I'm really excited for. This is a guy I've been a fan of for over a decade by now, Sage Francis. Sage, you know, has his roots in the battle rap world, in the slam poetry world, and he's turned all of that into this amazing personal style. His first album was, in fact, called Personal Journals, and that's exactly what it was. He caught a lot of people's attention back in 2001 with his song Makeshift Patriot, which was an immediate visceral response to the 9/11 attacks and the media's treatment of them and the rush to war that came out of that. He's released a bunch of really powerful albums, including his newest one, Copper Gone. We talk about all of that and his differences with some very prominent rappers. Macklemore, who he's been somewhat public about his feelings towards, and also Kanye West. He was kind enough to join us in the middle of his European tour. He was actually in France when we talked to him. He's someone I've been wanting to talk to for a really long time, and the conversation came out better than I could have expected. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sitaro.
Yeah, my next thing I do is gonna be even doper than that, but that's dope.
It's produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Powerful force as a producer and an MC.
Our website, thecyphershow.com, is by Paul Dice.
You were doing it because you just loved hip-hop.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I don't really like that track. Let's use a whole different one.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher. Doppler effect on Adele, huh?
Oh, dude. my son, who he was hiding in, because he didn't feel like going out this afternoon, learned at a very young age. He's like, is that getting louder? And are the notes changing? And I was like, yes, you've learned what it sounds like to have Jay-Z going past your window there.